Hello and welcome, listeners, to ION EDI, the anti-racism podcast where we unpack equity, diversity, and inclusion. This podcast is recorded on the unceded traditional territory of the Sequimic people. I am grateful for the opportunity to live, learn, and play on their lands.
Hi, Kyra. I'm so excited to have you here today. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Yeah, hi, I'm happy to be here, too. Curious about what we're going to talk about.
Nothing too scary. So you're the intercultural coordinator, correct?
True.
Okay, good. I got a question right. What does it mean to be an intercultural coordinator?
Oh, what does it mean?
I guess I could say, what exactly are you the coordinator of?
You'd like to know what exactly I do.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because actually TRU, I believe, was the first institution in Canada that actually created a permanent faculty position around intercultural learning. So I kind of created what I do based on need, right? So initially it was super responsive, just kind of following what the needs were. As you know, my position is within faculty student development, which is where many of the sort of pan-institutional type faculty positions reside, which means that I work with people all across campus. I actually have this nice visual that I created that's gotten very busy, but basically it's sort of this idea of the what used to be a strategic priority, but is still really a core element of TRU's values and vision, is this sort of intercultural understanding at the center. And then, of course, Faculty of Student Development, but at the same time, TRU World International Area and TRU Indigenous Education, and then also CELT, which is the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching. So I work with all those areas, and then, you know, what I do with those areas spans out in lots of different things. So the graphic got really busy, but that might sort of help you see that it's working with different areas and with different priorities, I guess, all with the ultimate goal of enhancing intercultural capacities and understanding across very diverse student groups, staff groups, faculty, etc.
So I guess we're going to be saying the word cultural quite a lot during this conversation. Maybe a good starting point would be to just, what does intercultural mean? Like, I've heard intercultural understanding, I've heard intercultural capacity. Is there a difference? Is it the same as multicultural? Like, what does this mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a good question, actually. I ask that question in a lot of workshops just to get the dialogue sort of going, right? You know, what multicultural, intercultural, what's the difference, right? And usually what we come to, and, you know, this will be through some dialogue and bringing in ideas of who's in the room, because there'll often be different perspectives. But in essence, we usually arrive that multiculturalism is about, you know, representation, right? And perhaps representation and maybe, you know, diversity in that representation. Whereas intercultural maybe moves a little bit differently than merely representation, and it's more a focus on interaction and inclusion, right? So we can have, you know, we have a multicultural campus, for example, right? There's no denying that TRU is very multicultural, very culturally diverse. But are we actually interacting, and are we being inclusive, and is the interaction a positive learning experience? And if not, how do we shift that, I guess, is the question, right? Because multiculturalism on its own, or diversity on its own, can also result in a lot of division, right? And maybe more entrenched stereotypes about others if we're not intentional about how we set folks up to dialogue with authenticity and to understand perspectives different than their own.
Do you think, or now you've got me hooked on this one idea, in some of the other conversations we talk about the difference between multiculturalism and the shift to intercultural understanding, and it always makes me think, because going back to when I was younger, I remember the focus was very much like just bring in diversity, and that's going to help bring about change, and that'll automatically increase what we understand as intercultural understanding. But in my experience, and in speaking with other people, I've noticed that that's not correct. Like, that doesn't always work that way, which I think highlights the importance of actual intercultural understanding, because then you're able to interact with people and provide them with an environment that'll help them thrive. It's kind of like, okay, so I've always wanted to be a goldfish person. Like, I've always wanted to have goldfish. I don't know why. They just look really nice to me after watching Nemo when I was young. And I always tried to keep them alive and it would never work. They just never stayed alive. And so it makes me think like maybe I was doing something wrong that wasn't helping them, like that wasn't providing them with the optimum environment. And I kind of think of people, like diverse groups of people, in a similar way. Because if you think of, say, students like coming from different cultural, religious, ethnic, et cetera, backgrounds, and you put them into a classroom or a university, and you don't change up the environment in any way. Say you had a beta fish before, now you put a goldfish in, and you haven't changed the environment. That fish or that student might not survive as well. Or even if they do well, even if they do make it through university, there may have been ways that it could have been better, or the fish may have had a harder time breathing or something like that. I know, my little fish analogy.
I like it because it is a bit of an aquarium, right? It's a nice analogy. I guess when you were talking, I was thinking about, and I'm trying to remember who the scholars are, but essentially it's this point that's been made over and over. I mean, we have 60 or 70 years worth of research, starting with Alport. In the 1960s began with a theory and research around The Nature of Prejudice, I think is the name of the book. And so this started this idea of intergroup contact. And there's been like multiple research studies, in fact, meta-analysis studies of, you know, how we need to prepare folks to interact across difference, right? And a lot of this is sort of the premise of some of the training that we do with faculty, right, is to help them to facilitate that learning across difference with various student groups and according to their discipline, right? Because what we know is that structural diversity alone is not enough to enact any kind of actual learning. And in fact, you know, the contact hypothesis that sort of underlies some of the intergroup contact theory work is that if we aren't intentional, if we don't set folks up for success and focus on skill development and, you know, like things like humility and communication skills, like sort of attitudes, knowledge and skills, I suppose, is very common in intercultural sort of training and theory. But if we're not intentional about that, it is very likely that, and in the case of students, if we just are throwing everyone together and not thinking about that analogy of the fish tank or who's getting the air time, right? Or who's getting the quality air. I guess it's not air, it's oxygen of some sort, isn't it? I don't know. I don't know enough about fish. But I think that when we don't do that, the potential for actually more entrenched stereotypes, more supposedly informed biases is, you know, going to be there, right? Because now we have students that can walk away and say, well, I know that about them because I studied with them for 4 years, or I had, you know what I mean? So I think there's a real potential for a not positive outcome as well if we're not really working towards some kind of a common goal together, right?
I definitely agree with that, because I think when we're interacting with people, we all interact with them in a different context. And I think it's easy to forget that, oh, the person that we're talking to, just they're not representing every person that comes from their culture. They're representing them in a specific moment, in a specific time, with their specific context. So one of the things that I really love about talking with you is that you provide a lot of like academic backgrounds to things that I talk about. It's like I have thoughts and ideas, but I never realized that there's actual literature into it. In my mind, literature was very focused on science or math, or I don't think I even thought of math as literature, to be honest. It was very scientific, and I didn't realize that there was so much research background that goes into this. But it was very experience-based.
It's actually a field of study.
Yeah, I did not know.
Well, and you know what? I think a lot of people don't know, right? I think a lot of people think, oh, all of this is really nice and it's kind of, you know, rainbows and butterflies. But is there, you know, actually, yes, the answer is there is actually, you know, theoretical constructs at the basis of what's the best or promising practices in terms of this. you know, depending, and as I said, you know, like really years and decades of research. And I think it's a very interdisciplinary field as well, right? Because we draw things from, I mean, my degree in studying this is in education, right? But we draw theories from sociology and psychology, right? So it's a very interdisciplinary, and communication too, right? Because communication is one of the skills that we really focus on in intercultural, right? It's being able to communicate with one another effectively goes a long way in mitigating, you know, misunderstandings and that bias entrenchment that I mentioned earlier, right?
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, you have a doctorate, don't you?
I do.
Okay, good. I was scared I was mistaken for a minute. So did you do your PhD in like interculturalism?
I did. Yeah. I did. Actually, I did. I started out at UBC and I did my undergrad degree in religious studies, which was an interesting choice at the time. At the time, the way that the religious studies department worked was really that you should focus and specialize in one religion, right? So students were encouraged to become, you know, scholars of Islam, for example, and you were encouraged to study Arabic, like the canonical language, if you will. And I was resistant to that and ended up getting special permission from the dean to do more of a like a comparative religious studies program. So that was interesting. But at the end of the day, you know, I think my parents were like, what are you going to do with that? and it was kind of like that. It was really useful for crossword puzzles, but not for a whole lot of other sort of things. So, and then my master's was in education as well as my doctorate in education. And in both the master's and the doctorate, I focused a lot on intercultural understanding. The master's, my research was actually with the nursing program at TRU. They were my participants. What I was doing was I created a pre-departure and sort of a mobility, education mobility abroad program for the nursing students that were doing their practicum in Samoa. Yeah. And then the study was around how effective, you know, having that pre-departure training was on their experience and understanding of some of the culture clashes they experienced while they were in practicum in a very, very different context, right?
You're just reminding me of, it's very off topic, but it reminded me of how sad I am that for now international placements have been canceled.
Yeah.
I've always, before I got into nursing, I was like, this school provides a lot of international options. I want to do this. Mm-hmm. And COVID happened, but sorry, I went off topic.
It might come back though before you're done.
Hopefully. Sorry, I went completely off topic. It just reminded me. So, what sparked your interest in, I know you said your undergrad was in religious studies, but what sparked your interest in exploring interculturalism?
Yeah. Well, I guess the path was, the undergrad was religious studies. I, you know, after I finished that, I spent probably a good, I'm just trying to think of the years, like it was a good 10 years that I was really just traveling all over the world. And through that, I also, you know, like many young people did then, was teaching English. So I did a stint as an ESL instructor. And I actually, years ago, even worked as an ESL instructor at TRU for a brief time. And so those experiences combined, I think, you know, understanding these, you know, profound differences in faith and what drives people and what their values are, combined with, you know, a lot of years of international travel and living, right? Not just going on vacay, right? and then as well, working with students that I was very aware early on that students, it wasn't just about learning English. We were translating culture in the classroom as well, right? And then, you know, really noticing differences of the expectations and assumptions of students from different cultural, academic and cultural contexts, right? So the expectations and assumptions about what's a good teacher, what's a good learner are really influenced by cultural values. And in some cases, those might be also influenced by faith values or even secular values as well, right?
That's really interesting that you point out, which is why it's interesting to me, to see the intersection between the academics and the lived experience, because I can talk on completely about the difference in educational values. And I think also like this, all the factors that go into putting those educational values into yourself. And it's something that I notice in myself and something that I can sympathize more with or empathize more with people who, especially, you know, children of immigrants like myself, who feel more of a higher pressure to do well in university or to even go to university in the first place, because it's kind of like, well, failure isn't really an option at this point. Like, what are we going to do? What's the backup plan? And so I understand that stress much more. So it made me wonder, like, what kind of, you mentioned that different expectations of teachers and learners. So what does that look like, per se?
Well, I mean, again, we've got all sorts of sort of theories. I don't want to confuse anyone who's listening that's not as familiar with those theories. But so, for example, we know that students that come from very high context cultures, which tend to be, not always, a little more on the collective side rather than individualist, they tend to be a little bit more hierarchical in nature rather than more of a flat thing. In some ways, a little bit more, hard to say, but relational in terms of that, the hierarchical relationship is different. So imagine that in a classroom, like the teacher asks, does anyone have any questions? Well, that student may be more reticent to put up their hand or to be that active learner that many in the more dominant mainstream culture have, in Canada at least, have been sort of socialized to, right? So, you know, an example that I often have has resonated with students in the classroom when we talk about this is, you know, if you go to an elementary school in Kamloops, you're going to see a very, very different educational environment than if you went to an elementary school in, you know, Tokyo, right? Because the way that children are socialized is different. And, you know, in Japan, they have a saying that, and every Japanese person I've ever asked if they know this saying, they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, and then they say it, right? And it's that the peg that sticks out, the translation is roughly, the peg that sticks out gets pounded down. So what does that mean? What are they being told? What are children being told? If the peg that sticks out gets pounded down, what's the message?
Like, if you're in a class, don't try and go against the grain or try to ask too many questions?
Yeah, or maybe like don't call attention to yourself, right? Don't stand out, right? I had a Japanese student actually explain to his classmates very eloquently one time that it's really about the difference between, you know, bragging about yourself or trying to make yourself like bring attention to yourself, right? And I thought that was interesting. But so there's the piece, the peg that sticks out gets pounded down. Highly collectivist culture, right? So everyone should stay on the same, like it's not about the individual, right? And you flip that and go like to an elementary school in Kamloops this morning, and you know, what are the kids doing there? They're all like, teacher, pick me, right? So it's fundamentally different in terms of even the behavior that's expected in the classroom. And then suddenly you bring students from all around the world and put them all in a learning environment together. Of course, the behaviors are going to be different, the expectations are going to be different, and their style and preference in communicating is going to be very different. And so you just have a lot going on. And with no awareness of that, it makes it tricky on the part for the faculty member to effectively teach so many different students, right?
Yeah. Oh my God. There's a light bulb that just went off in my head just as you said that, and the way that student explained that to you. Because, well, I speak quite a couple of languages, but one of the ones that we speak at home has a saying that is, but say like you have a pot and the emptiest one is going to make the most noise.
Okay.
And so it's like the person who has the least to offer, the least accomplishments, isn't making the most fuss out of their accomplishments.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if this isn't actually an English saying or if it's one, but it's been translated somehow into somewhere, but it's in the general vicinity of Pakistan. Yeah. That's where it comes from. But so for me, I didn't realize that, because that's something that I've always been told, like if you're very accomplished at something, you won't be the one who's telling people about it or about your accomplishments.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it came time to write, say, the nursing admissions letter, that was all about, like, it was like a pick me thing, right? Like, why should I pick you? and why should we pick AMNA? And so when I was writing scholarships letters and like admission letters, I always had that problem. Like, oh, well, how do I tell people why I'm so great? Because that's not something that I was like, you're supposed to do. You're supposed to not tell people that you're great and they're supposed to learn about your greatness.
Sure. And that's common across a variety of cultural contexts. And we know that, you know, speaking with, you know, colleagues in career education, it's a constant challenge to prepare some groups of international students for interviews in Canadian for jobs, because the whole thing is about, you know, telling us how great you are and then telling us what your 5-year goal is. And it's like, I don't know.
I don't know how to tell you I'm great because I'm not supposed to tell you I'm great. Again, that's why I love having conversations that bring out the academic side of it, because it kind of proves the fact that a lot of the things that students go through are actual classifications.
Well, and then if you think about it, you know, there's a lot of students who may come here to study for 4 to 6 years, and then they take those, you know, the values instilled in them from their discipline in North America back to their home context, and that may not be what the employer wants in that context, right? So I think we also have an obligation as the educators to be clear that, you know, these are the values that are, that the discipline is seen through from this cultural context, but it could be something else somewhere else, right?
Yeah, we were actually talking about that in one of our classes yesterday, about how different learning styles translate over into different cultures. And so for us, it was a teaching and learning. So nursing is a lot about teaching patients and teaching families about how they can go home and take care of the whoever had the injury or the sickness. And so what I really loved was that they talked about, the professor talked about different cultures and how you have to figure out if someone's resistant to that learning or doesn't want you to teach them, like, why is that? And how can you address it on an individual level? So one of the things that was mentioned was Indigenous ways of learning, I think they're called, and two-eyed seeing, and as well as about, like, say, if you don't you don't know the cultural context of the person, like, try to understand the person and their values and then work it within that. So it made me think of how the way you prepare students for interacting with, in our case, patients and clients, but I'm sure it's like similar across the university, the way you prepare students has an incredibly large effect. Because if we were just told, I would like to think I would not do that, but if we were told to just teach everybody the same way, it would be very like, there, you do that, and then you do that, and then you do that, regardless of whether the person understood what you're saying or whether it's applicable to their context.
Sure. And I think, you know, there, unfortunately, in some cases, there is the feeling that, you know, North American knowledge systems or Western knowledge systems are somehow, you know, superior, or that they're all that, right? You know, and I think some disciplines are potentially more guilty than others around that, but I think it's common enough. And I, you know, as academics, we're trained in our discipline, right? And so, you know, there's years and years of sort of socialization in the discipline coming through as well, right? So your nursing instructors would be very much around, you know, Western medicine, and you know, so I think things are changing a little bit in that regard, but not everywhere and not in every program.
Yeah. Well, I spoke to my specific area, but I've been noticing a shift in the last, say, 7 years towards more focus on interculturalism and anti-racism and just different ways of inclusion in education. Throughout high school, I was a student voice representative, so I went to provincial meetings to speak about, like, issues in our district. And just like through that, and through just through the years and through different media that I've been consuming, I've noticed a shift. And is that something that you notice throughout your role? Is that there is more willingness or just a more of an interest?
I guess so. Yeah, I'm not sure. If I think back on it over the span, absolutely. I mean, when we started doing some of this work at TRU, I don't think people were even familiar with the term, right? And then within a number of years, it actually became a strategic priority, which, you know, was, I was super excited when that happened. And, you know, to be honest with you, in the following months after intercultural became a strategic priority and therefore budgets and things get tied to it, there were moments where I was like, oh no, right? Because it was becoming overused and used for everything, right? Which is sort of typical with trends anyway. But, you know, I had a proposal that was sent to me where people were talking about intercultural furniture. And I was like, what is that? Right. You know, there's danger in having terms become too used as well, right? Yeah, I think though in general you're right, and you know, I think people know what needs to be done with EDI. A lot of people know what needs to be done and what we need to have in place. Unfortunately, what we want and what we're willing to pay for are often two different things. And you know, I honestly believe that the K-12 system has changed, and that, you know, there's a lot of people doing really good work in the K-12 system, for example, recognizing, you know, the need to support students with different learning abilities. But there just isn't the funding to actually support those students, right? And I would say the same for many things, right? We want equity, diversity, inclusion, but, you know, we're not always willing to like create positions that will actually do that work. And quite often equity work, both in the K-12 system and in higher ed, is done by equity deserving individuals off the sides of their desks, right? And I think that that's one of the obstacles that we really need to address, because, you know, there's a tendency to hire people in precarious positions to do the work, or just to expect folks that have lived experience to do the work when they're not, it's not part of their job description. So it's tricky, right? Because I think absolutely we need to strike the balance between lived experience and, you know, perhaps disciplinary expertise. But we have to understand, you know, who's doing the work and the labor of it, right? Because it, in many cases, it's emotional labor for folks, right?
Yeah, I like that you bring that up, because that was actually my next question. You provided me with the segue. Throughout just the last year, I've noticed that for me, there comes points like after, like especially like at the end of the month, I'll be like, nope, this is not worth it. Nothing's going to change. Everybody's going to think racism is the thing. I give up. Like I always have like 5 minutes of just giving up, and one day of like, nope, I don't care anymore. And I found even just personally experiencing discrimination, I think what really makes me more prone to it isn't just that I'm like my skin color, it's a lot of the Islamophobia, because I look visibly Muslim. So that's like the more overt forms of discrimination that I get. And I know, and for me, it's like, it's exhausting. It's so tiring. And so I wanted to ask you, like, do you have like coping mechanisms, or like, how do you work around that exhaustion around and the emotional burden around race, anti-racism work and intercultural work?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And you know what? I don't know if I've got it figured out yet. you know, I think a lot of it is finding like-minded people and supporting each other to some degree. You know, starting to, you know, you have to be able to say no to some things as well, right? And, you know, pick the things that you're really willing to go, and finding, you know, allies and people that are willing to, people that are in maybe in different positions or hold more power in the institution or society, that, you know, I can help them to move forward things like budgets or actual curricula or, right? So, you know, it's none of the EDI is not for, it's not a job for one position or one person. It's all of us, but it needs to be recognized as the work of everyone and you know, and rewarded for folks who are doing it. Yeah, if that makes sense, right? So I think some of the exhaustion is that for many people, they do a lot of the work off the side of their desk, and Yes, for many of them it is. Also, there's some emotional labor, right? Because you're pushing for something that's your reality as well, right? Or the reality of, you know, people very close to you or something like that quite often, right?
That's a good point that you brought up earlier, especially about funding, because it's so, I think if you want to get things done, you need to have resources to do it. And I think there's like, it's as simple as the fact that just last week, there's been this idea in my head around a research proposal for like my undergraduate research that I've had for about a while now. And it's been mulling and mulling, and it ended up being like it's an intersection between health and interculturalism, intercultural understanding. And I looked online to see if there was undergraduate funding for like racism, like working around like racism and health, like an intersection. And I was like, I cannot find anything.
I think a U-REAP might be your way to go.
Yeah, it probably. But I was looking just for interest, like, what is there stuff? And there isn't much things. And if there is, it's very competitive. And so I think sometimes that creates a barrier towards people overall. Like maybe there's no defined positions for intercultural work, or there isn't money for research, or people that are, like you said, people that are doing it off the side of their desk. And I think that can create a little bit of barrier towards progress, because if we had people that are dedicating their 9 hours of work a day or 8 hours of work a day on things, and it's an actual large team, it's like, well, we would get more things done.
Sure. And I mean, in some ways, you know, I should be careful because I do have a position that's dedicated, right? I certainly have that privilege to have that dedicated. The challenge is that if you're trying to motivate others, you're often asking them to do things to collaborate with you off the side of their desk. And so I'm always cognizant of that. And that goes for students as well, right? How, you know, the students that want to be involved. Actually, as we're speaking, I'm getting applications for ambassadors coming across my screen. So, you know, it's great that we can compensate through the ambassador program, but you know, that's only, you know, 10 students a year. So we have to find other ways to incentivize people to get involved, right? And to do that learning. So yeah, I think, you know, we're coming along slowly but surely.
So for people, I think sometimes it can be a little bit of, well, how does this help me? You know, because considering we only have 24 hours in a day. Sometimes I like to think that there's more. There's not, unfortunately. It's limited to 24. But so we only have 24 hours in a day, and so many things to do and so many things to learn. And especially as students, there's just always something happening. Mm-hmm. How does increased intercultural understanding benefit a person? What is it going to do for me?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, see, what we have is that in our culture, and certainly in our educational culture, it's always the individual end goal that we're after, right? I kind of want to push back against that, because I think that's part of the reason why we're in so many crises globally right now, is that, you know, the individual at the center of things doesn't work, right? And that goes for many things. So I think our education system, and I write about this, like, it needs a fundamental shift where we're not only preparing students for employment, right? We should be preparing students for citizenship. And those are two, I mean, or both, right? But why we've really gone quite far down the sort of role that education, higher education in the last probably 30 years has become more and more of an economic exercise, right? You know, I've heard people referring to students as the customer, and certainly when you're fee paying, you are a customer in some ways, right? Families making huge investments so that their child can, you know, have a step up for employment. I mean, there's all sorts of really good reasons for it. But I think in some ways we've lost the concept of education being for the common good, right? And you see, I mean, just go on the news today and you'll see what the result of that is, right? So, you know, so yeah, although I will say that in the current job market, in the current, you know, particularly because we live in an almost hyper-diverse context, I mean, if you're planning to be employed in Canada, you know, the StatsCan projects that by 2036, like 50% of Canadians will have been born outside the country or have parents born outside of the country, right? You know, that's huge. So there's no, you know, and immigration patterns have shifted. You know, in the 1970s, 80% of immigrants to Canada came from either Europe or the British Isles. It's not the case anymore, right? You know, now we have closer to 50% that are coming from Asia and South Asia, right? So, you know, and these are quite different culturally and linguistically and racially as well. So, you know, there's more and more diversity. What's in it for you? Well, because you're probably going to work with or manage or have clients or colleagues or that are from different worldviews, backgrounds than you, right? And so developing some skills and some understanding, probably going to make your life easier, but, you know, probably also going to make you more effective as a colleague, as a manager, yeah, as a client, or, you know, whatever. So I think that there is something there for the individual, but I think there's also something there for us to say, you know, we need to start figuring out how we can work together to solve some of these pretty colossal issues of our time, right?
Just that point that you made alone, I think highlights the importance of intercultural dialogue, because as you were talking about what it means to like be an educated person and how education in our context right now is preparing for employment, for me, it's actually kind of different because I'm not sure about, I can't generalize all of South Asia, but from my like little tiny little corner of it, or at least in the family context, because again, there's so many different ethnicities within one little pocket. So for my little tiny cultural context in that specific corner, again, I'm trying not to generalize for anybody else. It's that education is supposed to make you someone who's a broader understanding individual. So a lot of times you'll hear people say that, oh, that doesn't suit you as an educated individual, like, or as someone who's, or I'll hear it about somebody else, like, oh, that statement didn't suit you. You're an educated person. Or as an educated person, you should be aware of the world in this way. So it's a lot about like education isn't just the scientific education. It's also the cultural competence that you gain, the awareness of the world and different systems that you gain. So that again, just, it was a sidebar, but it interested me because it emphasizes the importance of understanding other people and what, even something as simple as like, what does education even mean to you?
Right. And I mean, what we've seen, and again, in the last few decades, is a real shift. And, you know, it's referred to by lots of people as the massification of education, yeah, but, you know, a shift away from arts and humanities, which were, you know, traditionally the place where, you know, these types of dialogues and, you know, disciplines like philosophy and history and sociology really look at these things in very specific detail, right? And there's less, you know, around the Western world, and for sure in North America, where there's a real shift away from those disciplines and more towards students being very pragmatic about the program that they take leading to employment, right? So, you know, we started this conversation with me telling you about my young self taking a religious studies degree. Well, you know, what would be the purpose of that these days? And even then, you know, that was in the, well, when was I doing that degree? I guess the late 80s, early 90s. And, you know, even then it was, and now you will be hard pressed to find a religious studies department in this country, right?
Yeah. I think the only one that I've heard of is in McGill, I think, Montreal, because they have that really beautiful Islamic studies library. Yeah.
Well, they do exist, right? They do exist.
But yeah, but you don't hear of it very much.
And yeah, that's funny because I did get accepted to McGill and UBC and ended up going to UBC. So I often wonder.
I've been inside that library, though, is the real question. I love libraries. So anytime I hear of anybody who's been to like an older library, it's kind of magical. Nice. Honestly. Nice. But yeah, so we've talked a little bit about the importance of interculturalism, why you should care, even though I think everybody should care regardless of the fact of whether it benefits you or not, because if we have a more inclusive society, it benefits everybody, you know? It's not just about like the immediate benefit to yourself, it's the overall benefit to everybody. But I want to ask, like, so say I'm a person, I could be a faculty member, a staff, a student, anybody, or just a human in general, and I want to make a shift towards increasing my intercultural understanding. What would you recommend as the first step to somebody?
Oh, I think getting out of your comfort zone and listening, right? Like with some humility, right? Because there's a lot to be gained from listening to others' perspectives. And I think from that, then we start to develop a little bit of cultural self-awareness, like, oh, maybe the way I was taught or what how I was raised or what I value is not universal. And that's a bit of a light bulb for a lot of folks who, are walking around thinking that everybody probably thinks much like them. And I don't think that's anyone's fault. I think it's the way we've been socialized, right? And particularly if you're a member of the dominant culture, you can cruise around with that as your kind of lens without knowing for quite a while, right? So it's getting out of your comfort zone, crossing the cultural boundaries, whether they be, you know, more ideological or perhaps faith-based, or whether they're racial or whether they're ethnic, whatever they are. And, you know, yeah, leaning in with a bit of humility and see what you can get from it.
Thank you so much, Kyra. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, me too.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thanks for inviting me.
You can find more information about this podcast, past episodes, and mental health supports on the website i-on-edi.tierubox.ca.